Okay, we're going to start into Zephaniah this evening. We're primarily going to introduce Zephaniah. I'm trying to think. I don't know about you, but I thought maybe it was helpful the last book kind of having something to fill in and follow along to help you think through the book a little bit better. I'm always kind of, I don't know if Ben does this, but I'm always evaluating how I teach and kind of my approach to different things to see if there's a better way to approach something. I don't know. Do you do that, Jim? You always kind of think maybe there's a better way to teach this or a better way to help students get it. Because if we spend all this time teaching and it's not helping you understand it any better, what we're trying to get at, then it's just a lot of hot air. And I've got enough of that. I can do that enough without. Anyway, Zephaniah, I want you to look in Zephaniah this evening to introduce this. Zephaniah chapter 1. I'm going to look just briefly at who Zephaniah is, or was, we should say, and then kind of get a time frame for this that Zephaniah provides for us. So Zephaniah chapter 1, Zephaniah is in the minor prophets. It's Hosea. Okay, so that kind of gives you an idea where it's at. Zephaniah chapter 1 then, verse 1 says, "And the word of the Lord, which was unto Zephaniah, son of Cushi, son of Gadaliah, son of Amariah, son of Hezekiah, in the days of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah." Yeah, I was there. When we were on vacation, when we were doing our Bible reading, I was having Peg read, or I was reading Zephaniah, or I had her read it to me the day she was reading. But we were reading through this on vacation every day. And I get down there, you got all those ayahs, and I get down there, king of Judah, you just threw that in, and she laughed. She thought that was funny. I do that for a couple times. But anyway, this is what's important about Zephaniah, first of all. Is there anybody in that list that stands out as somebody of note? Somebody you recognize?
Josiah.
Okay, recognize Josiah. Okay.
Hezekiah.
And Hezekiah. If you recognize anybody else in there, you're doing pretty good, other than Zephaniah, because those are the only two people that are really of note in this list. Josiah and Hezekiah. Hezekiah was a
king.
King of Judah. Probably one of Judah's greatest kings in terms of the righteousness. In fact, he implemented the keeping of the Passover, and we're told in the text where under Hezekiah that they had not kept the Passover like that. I'm going to draw a blank. I don't know if it's from the days of David or if it was from even prior to that, meaning that even in the time of David they didn't keep the Passover to the degree that they kept it under Hezekiah. I should have went back and reviewed that today, but I didn't think about that until just now. But that was Hezekiah, very notable king in Judah's history. So this tells us that Zephaniah is related how to Hezekiah?
Relative.
It's a relative. He's a great-great-grandson of Hezekiah, because he's son of Cushi, son of Gadaliah, son of Amariah. And so that tells us here that's what's special about Zephaniah's family. He is, in one sense, he's royalty. He's part of the royal family, which is important for us. Then we have this other individual. It says that this was in the days of Josiah, son of Ammon, king of Judah. Who is Josiah descended from?
Judah.
Okay. Is there anybody in that verse that he's descended from? He's descended from Ammon. Who was Ammon descended from? Ultimately, it doesn't tell you in the verse. I'm just seeing if you can put it together. But it's in that verse. He's descended from Hezekiah too.
Really?
Hezekiah was the king. He had a son. He had a son Manasseh that was no good. Manasseh was Josiah's son. Anyway, I'm going to get it straight. I'm not going to mess it up. But he has a son. Josiah is the great-grandson of Hezekiah.
Zephaniah is a great-great-grandson, but they come through different fathers, okay, or through different sons of Hezekiah. And we have no idea how many sons. In fact, one of the things I was going to do today was look up and see how many sons David had, because David had a lot of kids. Because if you were a king, you had to prove that your power to rule, part of your proving your power to rule was the ability to have a lot of kids. That was a really big deal, okay, for them. So we have no idea how many people were in Hezekiah's family. But one of the brothers produces the line that Josiah, the king at the time we're going to read Zephaniah, is born. And another son, he produces the line that Hezekiah comes through. So we've got two people that are, what would they be, fourth or fifth cousins? Okay. Or that Zephaniah. Zephaniah, yes, thank you. So we got Zephaniah and Josiah. They're one's great grandson, one's great great grandson, but they're contemporaries, which isn't hard to happen in the family, and they are fourth or fifth cousins within the family. Okay. And did they know each other in this regard? I think that they knew each other. Did they know each other as family? They probably did. Were they close as family? Hey, in a family this big, probably not. My grandfather's dad was the oldest of 15 kids. My grandfather was the oldest of my grandfather's family. He said when he would go back, he, as an adult that's married, he has first cousins that are babies. And he says most of his cousins he never knew. He never knew most of his cousins. I mean, a family of 15 kids, how in the world are you going to know all your cousins? It's just not possible. See? And so that happens. So I'm just trying to tell you, this happens in here. Zephaniah and Josiah are going to know each other through the prophecy and what's going on. But in terms of when I think of my first cousins, there were three kids in my family and four kids in my uncle's family, and that's my grandma and grandpa had two boys, and that's it. And so you got seven first cousins. That's not hard to get to know everybody. Okay, but my grandfather, I think my grandfather said he had over 50 first cousins. Okay, 50 people. That's a lot of people to keep track of, especially when you get an age spread in there like that. So just trying to get a picture in here that we're talking about royalty, we're talking about family, and we're talking about one a prophet and one a king in all of this. Most of our prophets do not have a pedigree like Zephaniah does. Most of them, we kind of know who their dad is, and that's all we know. The opening line of who this guy, that's all we know. But this guy we know, and there's a reason that we're told this pedigree. It's because it shows that this man has a relationship to the royal family, part of the royal family, in a distant way. And so, therefore, in a distant way, he's related to the king. That's important. Now, with that, I want you to turn back in your Bibles to 2 Chronicles. We're going to look at this for just a second. 2 Chronicles. We have here 2 Chronicles 34. Yeah, 2 Chronicles 34. I want to begin. I have on here 3 through 7, but just we're going to save some time because we're going to go over to 2 Kings here in just a minute. So we'll save some time by reading this in here. Verse 1 says, Josiah was 8 years old when he became king. That's kind of 8 years old. When he became king, he reigned 31 years in Jerusalem. He did right in the sight of the Lord and walked in the ways of his father David and did not turn aside to the right or to the left. For in the 8th year of his reign, while he was still a youth, he began to seek the God of his father David. So in the 8th year of his reign, which would make him 16 years old, and in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem in the high places, so that makes him 20. High places, the Asherim, the carved images, and the molten images, and they tore down the altars of the Baals in his presence, and the incense altars that were high above them he chopped down. Also the Asherim, the carved images, and the molten images He broke in pieces and ground to powder, scattered it on the graves of those who had sacrificed to them, and he burned the bones of the priests on their altars and purged Judah and Jerusalem, and in the cities of Manasseh, Ephraim, and Simeon, even as far as Naphtali, in their surrounding ruins. He also tore down the altars and beat the Asherim and the carved images into powder, chopped down all the incense altars throughout the land of Israel, and then returned to Jerusalem. So we have a young man who institutes a set of a real, what basically your Bibles or Bible teachers always call this, a set of reforms. He's reforming Judaism. Not from the way God gave it, but from basically what people had done with it. And we're going to see that when we go through Zephaniah. We're going to see that people, and we've kind of seen this in some of the other minor prophets, that they were worshiping other gods, but they're mixing the worship of other gods with the worship of their gods. And so Josiah is going to implement these changes. And Zephaniah, because he is writing about these things, as we're going through this, tells us that Zephaniah is writing this before these reforms are implemented. So they're relatives, but he's prophesying, even though he's the great-great-grandson of Hezekiah and Josiah is the great-grandson, he is prophesying ahead of these reforms, which are made, which begin to be made in the 20th year of Josiah. Okay, so Josiah is 20 years old, and it's prior to that that Zephaniah is prophesying. Now, I did come across one commentary that thinks that these prophecies are being made after Josiah's death, but it tells us in Zephaniah 1:1 that these are being made in the days of Josiah. If they're being made in the days of Josiah, they have to precede the reforms of Josiah. And we're going to see that when we go through Zephaniah. You're going to see what he's prophesying against and what's going to take place. And you're going to see, obviously, these reforms have not been implemented yet.
So then you're saying because of Zephaniah's message, then Josiah reformed?
We don't know that, but that's kind of an assumption. It never actually tells you that over here. But because you look at Zephaniah and we can put it in time over here, we would say that God used it as an influence on the people and what's going on and on the royalty. So turn over now. And I just thought this would be good because how many of you are well familiar with Zephaniah or with Josiah? We just kind of gave you a little bit. Why don't you go to 2 Chronicles? Or 2 Kings. I'm sorry. I'm looking at 2 Kings. Turn to 2 Kings. 22. I wanted to take 2 Kings, when you get there, turn to chapter 22. And I wanted to take a little time and I wanted to look at some things about Josiah and the reforms that were implemented. We kind of, 2 Chronicles gives us like this in a nutshell. 2 Kings. And you know the thing that I always thought this was amazing. In the church I grew up in, we used a set of Sunday school material that when you were in 4th, 5th, and 6th grade, I think is what it was. It was called the juniors, or 4th and 5th, I think, juniors. I don't know, whatever it was. And my teacher was Cecil. You went through all these historical books. So you had a worksheet every week that came with your book, and you read through these. And you had to have it all done before you came to Sunday school. So I remember a lot of Saturday nights. When everybody else is getting to watch TV, I got to go sit at the table and do my Sunday school lesson because I haven't done it. I've got to read these verses and I got to answer these questions and things like that. And I know then for a fact that we went through Josiah. But it wasn't until I was actually a pastor here that I remember when I was reading. It was a Saturday night. I couldn't sleep. I got up in the night and I was laying in bed reading. And that happened to be where I was reading at the time. And I read through this section in here, and I read about Josiah. And I was like, how is it that I don't ever remember reading about this? I mean, this is the most, I even went through seminary, and I don't remember coming across this. I must not have been listening, or it wasn't taught. This, to me, this is an incredible time in Israel's history. And we kind of read a little introduction to him. But in the first verses of chapter 22, we have Josiah sending people over to take care of things at the temple. What you basically find is the temple's sort of in a state of disrepair. They're still using it, but wait till you find out what they're using it for. But look in verse 8, and it says, "And Hilkiah the high priest said to Shaphan the scribe, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord." This is an amazing thing. What was Judaism really based on? God's covenant promises to Israel. And those covenant promises were in part embedded with this law that he'd given to them at this time. And it's amazing that they've got this covenant relationship with God, but they don't know anything about it, or very little. So it goes on, and it says, and Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, who read it. Shaphan, the scribe, came to the king and brought back the word. Word to the king said, your servants have emptied out the money that they found in the house. They've delivered it into the hand of the workmen who have oversight of the house of the Lord. Moreover, Shaphan, the scribe, told the king, saying, Hilkiah, the priest, has given me a book. Shaphan read it in the presence of the king. And it came about when the king heard the words of the book of the law that he tore his clothes. We don't do this, but this was their way of expressing extreme regret or grief. Then the king commanded Hilkiah the priest, Ahikam the son of Shaphan, Achbor the son of Micaiah, Shaphan the scribe, and Asaiah the king's servant, saying, go, inquire of the Lord for me and the people and all Judah concerning the words of this book that has been found.
That was mine.
For great is the wrath of the Lord that burns against us, because our fathers have not listened to the words of this book to do according to all that is written concerning us. Now, this is why, though Zephaniah has this prophecy that is contemporaneous with this, this shows you that what God uses in Josiah's life is actually seeing the book of the law and hearing it read and going, wait a second, we have this, and we've sinned grossly. I mean, could you imagine if you had been under this law that God had been given, but you didn't know what it was? So think of like the Ten Commandments. Shall have no other, you should not make graven images, you should not bow down to any other gods. And all of a sudden Josiah's thinking, everywhere you go, there's graven images. And everywhere you go, people are bowing down to these gods. And he's thinking, man, we've started right off of the top of the law. Breaking it. Okay. Have any of you ever been in a situation where you did something wrong, but you didn't really know it was wrong, and then somebody starts telling you about these things that are wrong, and you're sitting there, and you almost sheepishly start sinking into your chair going, oh, man, I'm guilty all over the place. Well, that's what Josiah is doing, verse 14. So Hilkiah the priest, Ahikam, and he goes through these guys. I'm going to skip over them. They go and they find a woman, Huldah the prophetess, there in verse 14, the wife of, and they go and they ask her. She said to them in verse 15, thus says the Lord God of Israel, tell the man who sent you to me, thus says the Lord, behold, I bring evil on this place and on its inhabitants, all the words of the book which the king of Judah has read, because they've forsaken me, have burned incense to other gods, that they might provoke me to anger with all the work of their hands. Therefore my wrath burns against this place, and it shall not be quenched. But to the king of Judah who sent you to inquire of the Lord, thus shall you say to him, thus says the Lord God of Israel, the words which you have heard, because your heart was tender and you humbled yourself before the Lord. And I see the Lord is speaking through this prophetess. Lord knows what the guy did. He knows how Josiah responded to the law. And when you heard what I spoke against this place and against the inhabitants, that they should become a desolation and a curse, and you have torn your clothes and wept before me, I truly have heard you, declares the Lord. Therefore, behold, I will gather you to your fathers, and you shall be gathered to your grave in peace. Neither shall your eyes see all the evil which I will bring on this place. So they brought back word to the king. Now, there's another statement if you look back in verse 19. It says, because, I'm going to read this again, because the heart was tender and you humbled yourself before the Lord when you heard what I spoke against this place and against its inhabitants. Now, there's a possibility in verse 19 that in conjunction with hearing the law, that he also now has heard the prophecy of Zephaniah. And he is now going to repent. And so God then, because of this, gives him the promise in verse 20, I'm still bringing judgment on this place, but you're not going to see it. You're going to pass away before I bring the judgment on this place. Verse, then it goes on and you can begin to see what they do. They actually bring the law down to the temple. They read it in the hearing so the people of the city can hear it. And then we begin to have these reforms. Verse 4 of chapter 23, then the king commanded Hilkiah the high priest and the priests of the second order and the doorkeepers to bring out of the temple. See, temple's in disrepair, but notice this. Bring out of the temple of the Lord, or Jehovah, all the vessels that were made for Baal. Could you imagine if you showed up for church on Sunday and we had all kinds of vile idols in there? And we'd gone and we'd slain chickens and sprinkled blood around, and we had
Zeus.
We had an image. I mean, we just, if you'd walk in and you'd say, what is the matter with these people? But that's what they were doing in the house of God. They brought up all these images and all these vessels for Asherah. Asherah, remember, if you remember in Hosea, Asherah is the wife of Baal. So you have a god and goddess system. You had it in the north. It's one of the reasons that God took the northern tribes away, because they bowed down to Baal. So he took them away to Assyria. They're gone by this time, of course, if you remember that. And for all the host of heaven. So they've got a whole pantheon of gods up there where they're worshiping all these little gods. This host of heaven is important because this comes up again over in Zephaniah, that these people were bowing down to the hosts of heaven. And he burned them outside Jerusalem. So they take everything that's in the temple, they bring it all outside, they take it out of the city, they burn it in the fields of the Kidron, that is the valley, and carried their ashes to Bethel. And he did away with the idolatrous priests. We're going to see those guys over in Zephaniah, whom the kings of Judah had appointed to burn incense in the high places in the cities of Judah and in the surrounding area of Jerusalem, and who also burned incense to Baal. So they're burnt, and it says they also burned incense to Baal. So they're burning incense on the high places to whom? Well, we're going to read in Zephaniah, they're trying to worship Jehovah and Baal at the same time. And Milcom, the Ammonite god. It's the Ammonites' version of Baal. Okay. Remember all these, you know, if you remember that, all these people around the Mediterranean, most all of them go back to Baal worship. And then they break it out and they have different names for Baal. But in almost all of these, Baal is the god of harvest and god of thunder. So he's Zeus to the Greeks. He's Jupiter to the Romans. You can go on up into Norway. He's Thor. All of these people, they all basically have these gods. The Ammonites have Milcom, these Moloch for the, I think it's the Moabites. So they all have the same God. They just have given him different names and kind of given him at times, they tweak the religion. And in all of these, he always has a wife. And in all of them, he and his wife need to procreate in order to make the land fertile. If you want crops, if you want the God of thunder to bless you with rain so that you have rain and you have healthy crops, you have to get them to, and in order, as we talked about this, in order to get them to do that, that's the way they frequently carried on. So you carried on in front of them, hoping to incite them to carry on like that. We went through that in Hosea, if you remember. And you're going to see some of that when we go through Zephaniah with the people that are hauled away.
I noticed in that verse 5, it says they burned incense to Baal, and to the sun, and to the moon, and to the constellations, and to all the hosts of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So what was the relationship to the sun and the moon?
Well, they worshipped them. They're sun worshippers and moon worshippers, and worshipping the different gods and the constellations. That, remember, that started back as far as Tower of Babel. It's what the whole Tower of Babel was all about. It was about essentially the worship of these gods that they saw in the stars.
Does Islam have some relationship to the moon?
Well, Allah is the moon god originally. Because Muhammad... The Arab people that were there actually were pantheists. So they had a lot of different gods they worshipped. And Muhammad took one of their gods, happened to be the moon god, and made him the only god, and then made him, and then created a monotheistic religion out of a pantheistic religion, taking the moon god, which is what Allah was. Okay. Now, I could be wrong in that, but if I remember from what I've studied on Islam, that's the gist of what was involved. We have we have these images. Verse 6, he brought out the Asherah from the house of the Lord outside Jerusalem, the brook Kidron, and burned it there. And the Asherah were usually wooden poles. So they would take these wooden poles that they had there, and they would take the wooden poles outside and burn them. That's why they're burning them, just to help you understand what's happening. At the brook Kidron, and ground it to dust. So they burn it and grind them to dust. Threw the dust on the graves of the common people. They broke down the houses of the, if you have a New American Standard, it's just the worshipful or worshipful prostitutes, and it's masculine, which is why they say male. Yeah, but this is, remember, this was part of what they did in that religion to Baal, which were in the house of the Lord. So they built all these little tents, hanging tents that they hung in there, that these people would climb into. And it says where the women were weaving these shelters, they have them translated in the NASB hangings. I think if you look in the margin, it says, or tents, but literally they were houses or shelters for the Asherah. So they had all these hanging tents that were in there, and then you had all these men that participated and acted in all this. They brought all the priests from the city of Judah and defiled the high places where the priests had burned incense from Geba to Beersheba, broke down the high places of the gates that were at the entrance of the gate of Joshua, the governor of the city, which are on one's left in the city gate. Nevertheless, the priests of the high place did not go up to the altar of the Lord Jehovah because they ate unleavened bread among their brothers. I just want to see what else I wanted to catch here. I wanted to go down through verse 15. He also defiled Topheth, which is in the valley of the son of Hinnom. Topheth being a furnace or burning place that they have down here, so that no man might make his son or daughter pass through the fire of Molech. And we remember we already talked about that when we went through Hosea. Isaiah talks about that too, how they were burning. To show your sincerity of worship, you burned your children. But you didn't just burn any child. What you burned was your heir. Who was your heir? Your firstborn. And I don't know if you remember it, but when we went through Hosea, I can't think of who's the famous historical North African Hannibal. When you were talking about Hannibal, his father burned many other children so that his son wouldn't have to be burned. The city that Hannibal was raised in, they have excavated, and I do not remember. I think they found the bones, burned bones of over 26,000 children in just the excavation that they've done already. Of course, you've got modern liberals today that want to say, oh, no, there was no child sacrifice. But the thing is, history is replete with writings about the fact that they did. But they want to think these people were way more civilized than to do that. But the thing was, is they had a God that demanded the death of everyone's firstborn. How did God, and we've talked about this before, just to remind you, how did God set himself apart from that kind of a false worship? What did he do?
By telling Abraham not to do it.
Yeah, you're not going to kill your firstborn. And not only that, but then what did
murder.
He... What?
Do not commit murder.
Well, but there's even something more than that. You purchased your firstborn to God. You took, remember... When Jesus was presented, they took the turtle doves up there, and that was because they were a poor family. But if you're a family that had means, and I should have reviewed this for tonight, but you either took a ram or a bull up, and you offered a sacrifice, and you redeemed your firstborn. That's what God required of them. We're not going to kill the child. You're going to redeem the child. The first child, in that sense, belongs to God. Just to remind you this, I want to skip over the burning of the chariots. We're going to skip over some of this. Go to verse 13, in the high places which were before Jerusalem, which were on the right of the Mount of Destruction, which Solomon, the king of Israel, had built for Ashtoreth. Solomon, that great king, with all of his wisdom, built all these things for all these wives that he had. The abomination of the Sidonians, which were the people here to the north of them, and for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Milcom, the abomination of the sons of Ammon, the king defiled. He broke in pieces the sacred pillars, cut down the Asherim, and filled their places with human bones. Furthermore, the altar, now this is important, furthermore, the altar that was at Bethel and the high place which Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin, had made even that altar in the high place he broke down. Then he demolished its stones, ground them to... Isn't it amazing? You just don't get these things over. You break all the stones up, and then you grind them to dust. It just always amazed me that, I mean, he's like, we're going to stamp this out. We're going to stamp this out, even if it means... I don't even want him to pick these stones up and try to put them back together. We're going to grind them to dust. There's nothing going to be left. And then they burn the Asherah.
But as soon as he dies, his son does the opposite.
Yeah, his son turns right around. They even take the bones of the false prophets out. They burn all those. But if you come to verse 17, and then he said, what is this monument that I see? And the men of the city told him, it is the grave of the man of God who came from Judah and proclaimed these things which you have done before the altar of Bethel. And back in the book of 1 Kings, when the kingdom, you had the split of the kingdom in here. You had this priest or this prophet that came, and he said, this altar is going to be tipped over because God is going to raise up a man, and his name will be Josiah. Long before, this is way early back, there's a man by the name of Josiah, and he's
13.
Yeah, and he's going to take it down. So it's
what was the name of the prophet who prophesied that again?
Yeah, I don't know. I couldn't tell you his name, actually. We just read about that just about a week ago. But I didn't look at that for tonight. I'm sorry, I'm not.
Verse 2.
Does it give his name in 1 Kings 13?
13:2. Behold, the child of Josiah by the name shall be born on the house of David.
Josiah by name.
That's the name of the king that's going to... And see, I don't think the prophet's name.
Unnamed prophet, yeah.
Yeah.
Just the old prophet.
Okay.
Yeah. But he speaks against this thing. So it's interesting here, these many years before, when Jeroboam first is taken away. And if you go back here, you know, we think it's amazing when Isaiah, over 100 years before, prophesies of Cyrus, the Persian, releasing Judah and letting them go back to the land. We think that that's an amazing thing. But if you think about Jeroboam is reigning, so that prophet is speaking prior to 910, and we're down here in the time of, I'm in the wrong one, the reign of Josiah here, and so we're looking about 610. So we're saying that prophecy's made where he is named by name over 300 years earlier. We have these people named by name. Anyway, I wanted to go over that. We could go on and we could read the reinstitute the Passover in here. This is the point. Flip back to Zephaniah, and I want to read through these opening verses in Zephaniah before we finish here this evening. Zephaniah, I want to go to verse 2, and just follow along as I read some of the things that we have just made a reference to now. It says, and I will completely, because these will be fresh in your mind now tonight, I will completely remove all these things from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. I will remove man and beast. I will remove the birds of the sky and the fish of the sea, the ruins along with the wicked, and I will cut off man from the face of the earth, declares the Lord. So I will stretch out my hand against Judah and against the inhabitants of Jerusalem. I will cut off the remnant of Baal from this place, the names of the idolatrous priests along with the priests. We saw that, those priests getting taken out. And those who bow down on the housetop to the hosts of heaven. We saw reference to that twice over in that section. And those who bow down and swear to the Lord and yet swear by Milcom. See, they're doing both. They're mixing both. They think they can worship Jehovah and Milcom. Milcom being the Ammonite god. And those who have turned back from following the Lord and those who have not sought the Lord or inquired of him. Be silent before the Lord God, for the day of the Lord is near, for the Lord has prepared a sacrifice, and he has consecrated his guests. And it will come about on the day of the Lord's sacrifice that I will punish the princes and the king's sons, and all who clothe themselves with foreign garments, and I will punish on that day all who leap at the threshold. We're going to talk about what this means. Anyway, he goes on there, and he's going to give more detailed descriptions of what he's going to do to the city. Let me just see if there was one other statement in here. Verse 13 is not the one I wanted to go to. We're going to save the rest of it when we get there. I just wanted to just see a little bit that what we were saying tonight about what he was doing, or what Josiah implements, those were the problems that the people were having. But as Ben made mention of, Josiah institutes these reforms as a result of finding the book of the law, also most likely because of the prophecy of Zephaniah. And yet when Josiah dies, because he goes off to war, God says, just stay home. The war will be fine. Josiah's like, no, I'm going to go out and see how the war is going. He goes out and he gets shot. And God said, God's like, I told you to stay home. He obeyed the God, but he didn't. He wanted to go out and check the war. He said, we're trying to be obstinate, you know, but anyway. But this is what happens. And his son reigns in his place. And his sons reinstitute everything that he had undone. And in a short space of time, all the wrath that God promises in the book of Zephaniah is going to come down on the people. And it's going to involve the Babylonians, and that's what our study is going to be on. So tonight, you basically were able to answer two questions on there. We're going to wait. We'll come back. I can give you the structure. We'll list the three-part structure, and then we'll... just to kind of give you an idea, the structure, first of all, is that we have two judgment speeches. Those are the first two dashes there. Judgment speech one, judgment speech two, however you want to write that. I didn't give you a lot of space to do that. I should have spaced those out more. Sorry. So judgment speech one, judgment speech two. And then we have a promise of restoration. And I'll connect some scriptures. Judgment speech one is chapter 1, verses 2 through 18, if you're interested. Is one chapter 1, 2 through 18. Judgment speech 2 is chapter 2. Well, I didn't mark all this down, but it's chapter 2, verse 4 through 3:7. I do have it here. And then the restoration is chapter 3, verses 10 through 20. Now there are two other things that are connected with each of those. It's not part of the main structure, but they go along with it, and each one of them follows Judgment Speech 1 and Judgment Speech 2. If you look at the verses, you're going to see you're coming up short on verses, because verses 1 through 3 of chapter 2 are a call to seek God. In other words, this is what the prophets did. The prophets didn't say, God's going to judge you. The prophets came along. Normally, if they were in most of our prophets, they come along and they prophesy God's judgment, and then there's a pleading to turn back to God. We've seen that in most of these. And so, first three verses is seek God. You got the chance to seek him right now. The temple. I mean, think they're going to be getting the temple organized. They could go up and seek the temple and wouldn't have all this other false God and Baal stuff up there. And then chapter 3, verses 8 and 9, there's a call to wait. And we'll explain what that call to wait is when we get to that part of the study. It's different than the call to seek. Okay. We did happen to answer the question about Zephaniah's family. We answered that tonight. He's distant cousin to Josiah the king. He's royalty. And then we saw that what is implied about his relationship to Josiah, if we go over and look at 2 Chronicles 34, that obviously that they are cousins in this regard. So really, the first one, Zephaniah's family, is that they're he's royalty. Second Chronicles 34 is that they're cousins. So it's kind of, I didn't answer the question right there for you.
So how is he a prophet?
How is Zephaniah a prophet?
Yeah.
Well, he's going to prophesy about God's judgment, which is what we looked briefly, that the day of the Lord's coming, that God's going to bring judgment on them. And then in connection with that, then he's going to call on them to change. He's going to call on them to seek God, and eventually going to call on them to wait for God to come and bring judgment.
Is he involved in priestly duty at all?
No, and he shouldn't have been a priest because he was from the tribe of Judah, not from the tribe of Levi. So,
is it common to have? I just don't know minor prophets well enough. Are many of them royalty?
Most of them we don't know anything about. Most of them we. Zephaniah is like one of the few prophets that we actually kind of have a little bit of his lineage. A lot of them, it just tells you who their dad is.
So how far removed, because he's a relative of King David too, how far along is that?
Could actually answer the next question. When did Zephaniah prophesy? He prophesies before 622 B.C., because that's when Josiah begins to implement his reforms. We know that because it tells in what year of his reign. And we also know historically has to be before 612, because that's when Nineveh falls. Nineveh is still standing in this book. Okay. But
David
is right around 1000. So we're looking at almost 400 years after the reign of David.
Maybe five generations.
Because if you remember, you have David and you have Solomon, and then Solomon's son Rehoboam reigns, and it's under Rehoboam that God actually is going to take the 10 northern tribes away. He says, I'm going to take the 10 northern, take them away. We always talk about Jeroboam taking them away. Well, what Jeroboam did was make them stop going to Jerusalem to worship God. God never stated that. He says, trust me, you can be king and they will go to Jerusalem. But he didn't trust them, and so he sets up those false altars, one in Dan and one in Bethel. And it's during Jeroboam's reign that we just made that note over there, 1 Kings 13, that prophet prophesied Josiah 300 years earlier before this. So David's approximately 400 years earlier. That prophet prophesied of Josiah's existence about 300 years earlier, roughly. So, kind of gives you a place to hang this. And the reason we've skipped Habakkuk is because Habakkuk technically probably prophesies after the time of Zephaniah. Okay. So, just keep in mind, when you read your prophets, they're not in chronological order, the way they're listed, with the exception of Malachi, which was the last of the Old Testament prophets. Never tells you that these guys were put together in chronological order. So...
So then, you know, we'll go into detail, like, you know, in chapter 1, verse 8, then it'll come about on the day of the Lord's sacrifice, they'll punish the princes. We'll talk about that more later. Okay.
Yeah, we'll come back. Yeah, I wanted to kind of rehearse what happened with Josiah as a result of this, and I wanted you to see when we read this that these very things that our issues over here are prophesied against in the book of Zephaniah, which tells you Zephaniah is prophesying during the reign of Josiah before. Can't be prophesying about him after, because then it wouldn't be during the reign of Josiah, because those things weren't reinstituted during his reign. They were reinstituted during his son's reign after he dies. Okay.
I thought it was interesting what, you know, you said God promised... promised Josiah that he would be spared the judgment, but so essentially by death. I thought, that's kind of odd. You know, I wouldn't think of God's doing me a favor by killing me so I wouldn't have to go through something, but that is actually a thing of mercy or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, so he didn't have to go through a living hell, you know, with what was going to happen when God judged them for their disobedience. But when he first said that, read that, I was like, I wouldn't naturally think that. You're doing me a favor by killing me.
You have the same thing over in the book of Revelation, where there's a prophecy or a statement over there. Happy are those now who are dead in the Lord, because they're not going to have to live through the stuff at the end of the tribulation period. So he says, happy are those people. Yeah.
That isn't a natural, I mean, it's not a natural way to think.
No, it isn't.
Who's Josiah's kid?
What? I mean, I'm sure I'd Stinker's name, yeah.
He's the one who takes over.
Is it, is it Zedekiah or Jeconiah?
Second Kings.
Like, I always, you know, I mean, the story of the Old Testament is failure, repentance, somebody cleans house, and failure. It's like, where are these guys' kids when they're going through all this stuff?
Jehoshaphat's
kids.
You think Josiah's kid or Hezekiah's kid would have done well, because they had a good example, but it didn't turn out that way.
Well, just because the kid just said, well, I'm not going to do it Dad's way.
Yeah, I mean, I know what happens, but it's like,
makes you wonder, yeah.
I wonder if that's a roller coaster, you know? Yeah, it's fine.
It's Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, made him king. He was 23 years old when he became king.
What verse is that?
36:2. 2 Chronicles 36:2.
Or 2 Kings 23:31.
So Josiah dies and he's about 40.
Well, he starts reigning when he's 8. He reigns 31. Yeah, 40 years old. So, and I was going to try and see how old he is. So he's 17 when he has his first kid.
He must have had a tremendous relationship with the high priest.
Because Josiah.
An 8-year-old kid to make all those decisions.
Yeah, well, he doesn't make decisions until he, remember, until he's 16 is when he starts to seek God. Well, they probably, yeah, he probably had a cabinet that was probably running a lot of the fairs in his youth. Of course, we assume that. We don't know that. They might have been so superstitious about the king that they might have allowed an 8-year-old to be making decisions, but I don't know that for sure. Oh, but see, his son, that's why it is. It is Jehoiakim that reigns, his son, because Jehoahaz, his son, only reigns 3 months in Jerusalem.
That's Jehoiakim.
And the king of Egypt deposed him, and then Jehoiakim was 25 years old and he became king. That, see, he was the one, because he was the one that started getting them into trouble with Babylon. So, and then he gets hauled off, and then they end up with Zedekiah, and so. Yeah, but you really do have a lot of, for whatever reason, you end up having a lot of family problems. Let's put it this way. In the Old Testament, it says, train up a child and the way he will go, and after he is old, he will not depart from it. But ultimately, in the end, you do not have the ability to make your children make spiritual choices any more than you have the ability. I mean, a husband can't make his wife make spiritual choices. The wife can't make the husband make spiritual choices. Even when your kids are growing up, you can't make them make spiritual choices. You can make choices for them of a spiritual nature, but in the end, like, you can make them go to church. That doesn't mean they're really getting anything out of it. They might be getting facts, but to them, it's all like, I wouldn't vote to do this. If you gave them the choice, what would you like to do? They'd probably say, let's watch TV. For all you know, or let's go play ball. You don't know. It's just, the point is, you can't instill spirituality in other people. Now, that's from a New Testament point of view, but even in the Old Testament, you can't instill righteous character in another person.
Or cause them to be,
Or even cause them to be a believer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't even do that. You don't have that control. Yeah. It's a hard thing. It's a hard thing to face when you think about that. So, anything else? Don't want to end on a depressing note. That sounds like a depressing note. Let's put it this way. In the end,
God's in control.
In the end, the righteous, those who are righteous, are almost always the exception with regard to humanity. Humanity is dominated predominantly by the unrighteous. So. Okay, well, let's shut this down.